It was a bright January morning on the island of Mindoro in the Philippines. And it was a clear blue sky, but there was some white clouds, little puffy white clouds that were moving along, but they were being pushed by a pretty stiff wind. So there's this wind that's really blowing. But Lunito, one of our elders, was not looking at the sky. He was bent over building a rice paddy. Now, for those of you who don't know how they build rice paddies, over there anyway, they take first a machete and they cut down all the trees and the brush that's on their field. And then they take a shovel and they dig out all the stumps and the roots and everything. Then they plow their field with, it's an iron plowshare bolted to a stick. And then that's pushed or pulled by a water buffalo. And if they don't have a buffalo, they'll actually use a person. Then they will dig a ditch from that field to their water source and flood the field with water. Then they will mix that dirt and water together, make mud, and they'll form little dikes, a little dike about this high all the way around the field with an entrance for the water and an exit for the water. Then they will take a harrow, which looks like a giant comb with a handle on it, and they will again use the water buffalo, and they'll harrow that field. And now they're finally ready to plant the stalks in the mud, one stalk at a time. So it takes really strong backs, let me tell you, to plant those rice plants like that. Well, it's a very labor-intensive process. Well, to save himself time, Lunito, who is a church elder, built himself this little doghouse hut. It was about this high, about that wide, where he could spend the night and sleep there instead of walking all those kilometers back home. And he hired an old man and a young boy to collect firewood and to cook his meals so, you know, he could focus just on the rice paddy. Well, Lunito didn't know it, but somewhere several miles upwind, somebody's walking along the path and they're smoking a cigarette. And when they were done, they just flipped it off and kept walking. But the strong wind started, made the embers in the cigarette start glowing, and pretty soon there was a small fire there in the dry grass. The wind kept blowing, the fire got bigger, and pretty soon it was licking up some nearby trees and some brush, but Lunito didn't see it. Now there was a large patch on fire, and some trees started burning, and the fire started moving, being pushed along by the wind. And it sent a plume of smoke up in the air, but Lunito was bent over working and didn't see it. Now it was roaring. Fire comes almost like a living thing, you know. And it had grown about a half a mile in length, and flames were going up about 20 feet. And it was pushing, the wind was pushing it directly towards Lunito's field. And the flames, you know, just leaving everything bare and black behind it. But Lunito kept on working. Now whole trees would just burst from the superheated flames. And the flames went into a bamboo thicket. And when that happens, the air in the bamboo joints expands and starts blowing off like little bombs. And it spreads the fire tremendously with all that fire and ash going everywhere. And the fire came right to the edge of Lunito's field. But he was so busy, he did not hear the explosions. But Lunito's friend, the old man and the boy, were busy cooking a pot of rice there in front of the hut. And they heard the explosion, and they look up, and they see this wall of flame coming directly towards them, and they began screaming at Lunito, but he didn't hear them. Now the fire was a mile long. Flames were going 30 and 40 feet high. It was moving fast, and it was right almost at the edge of his field. And finally, you know, the sun started darkening from all the smoke and the cinders and that was whirling around. And Lunito looked up to see what had cut off the light. And here he sees this wall of flame coming directly towards him. Well, he screamed, he dropped his shovel, and he ran back, ordered his friends inside, and he takes his machete, and he desperately, like a maniac, trying to cut the brush and grass between the fire and his hut. But it was too late. The fire was almost on him. Finally, he stopped with his back to his hut, and he faced that wall of flames in front of him. And his skin began to blister, and he couldn't breathe, and he realized that he was going to die. But then his mind started racing, and it's funny, when you're in a life and death situation, how clearly your brain works. I mean, things just flash. And he was puzzled, actually, to find out that actually he's at peace with death. He was the son of a very powerful witch doctor, or a chief, and he himself was a very powerful witch doctor who had many different spirits who obeyed what he told him to do. And God had taken that Lunito, and he turned him into a humble worker for him. He had fallen many times, and he still does, but God had picked him back up, just like we talked about the other week, where a saint falls down, he gets back up. He falls down, he gets back up. God had always picked him back up and put him on the path that he wanted him to follow. And now he realized that actually he was at peace with God and with death. And so into that swirling, boiling wall of flame, he yells at God. He says, God, if you want me to live, I know you can save me, but if you want me to die, it's okay with me. Lunito was facing an impossible situation. But he's not been the first of God's people to face impossible situations. Down through the dusty centuries of time, over and over, God's people have faced impossible situations, impossible circumstances, impossible problems. In fact, the Bible's filled with more stories of, I think, of that class of story where people have faced impossibilities than any other class of story there is in there. Elijah, he's alone on Mount Carmel. He'd spent the day taunting the priests of Baal and making fun of the priests of Baal. They had anger in their hearts, I think. They were, if fire didn't come down out of heaven, Elijah was a dead man. And so you know that Elijah had to have been tense, you know, wondering, is God really going to send fire down or not? And I know if I was in that situation, I would be, you know, even if I'm confident God can do it, until the actually fire flashes down, you've still got that little bit in your mind saying, I wonder if he'll do that. Not Elijah. What's he do? He goes and gets a whole bunch of water and dumps it all over the sacrifice. Now, do you think God was up there in heaven saying, Elijah, why did you do that? It's almost impossible for me to get fire down there, and now you've gone and made it all wet. You think God was saying that? No. He was saying, way to go, Elijah. That is a great idea. Hey, pour some more water on it. In fact, soak that thing so much that when fire comes down, people are going to know that I am God. And guess what? Stand back, Elijah. This fire is going to hit right there in the middle of that altar, and pow, fire comes down and burns up the sacrifice, the wood, the water, and even the very stones. For you see, God enjoys answering, or he enjoys doing the impossible in response to the prayer of faith. Elijah had prayed earnestly that it was not going to rain for 3.5 years, and it didn't rain. Elijah prayed earnestly that God would send fire down, and God sent fire down. God always answers the prayer of faith. Now, it may not be in the way that you want it or that I want it, but he will answer it, guaranteed. In Matthew 17, we find the disciples failing to drive out a demon, and they ask Jesus why this happened, and he says, because you have so little what? Faith. I tell you the truth, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it will move. Nothing will be impossible. Or does it say some things will be impossible? It says nothing will be impossible for you. My friends, that is a powerful promise. That is a powerful promise. Do you really believe it? Or do you think maybe Jesus is speaking in parables or figure of speech or something? When is the last time that you and I asked God to move a mountain? I think God is longing to do the impossible, but how often do we even ask him, let alone with the faith necessary for him to do it? You see, here in America, and I don't think I ever realized it until we actually lived so long, you know, 14 years in another country, is that we have it all. We don't need God. You know, we have hospitals, we have clinics, doctors, cell phones, radio phones, we have hardware stores, we have plumbers, electricians, we have everything we need. What do we need God for? When something happens, do we pray to God? No, we call the plumber first. I'm not saying it's wrong for us not to use these resources God has given us. God has blessed this nation to be a blessing, and we need to use them. But I think that we need to look at everything with a different mindset. You know, a mindset that takes God's power into play, into the equation, let's say. It takes God's power into the equation when we're dealing with problems. What do I mean? I mean that it seems like, you know, maybe you're different, but for me, when I have a problem, I attempt to solve it my own way, and then I kind of tack prayer on the end as a way to just cover all the bases. You know, make sure I get it done. What happens if we think about this and say, Lord, I can call the plumber or the electrician, but is there something else you want me to do? Or how to look at it from the viewpoint of God, to look at our problems from God's viewpoint. That's what I'm trying to say. God enjoys doing the impossible if we only had enough faith to allow him to do it. And Don, I think here we go. You remember the three Hebrews when they remain standing, sticking out like a sore thumb when there's probably thousands or maybe hundreds of thousands of people were all bowed down, worshiping the image of gold. And you remember what they said to King Nebuchadnezzar when he sat there on his throne, you know, surrounded, light from the furnace showing all, you know, showing him him sitting there in all his grandeur and everything with his court around him. And what did these three Hebrews say? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied to the king. We're talking about when he ordered them to worship. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to defend ourselves before you in this matter. If we are thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to save us from it, and he will rescue us from your hand, O king. But, even they have a but. But what do they say? Even if he does not, we want you to know, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the image of gold you have set up. Mindset. You think God was up there in heaven saying, oh, Shadrach, I wish you hadn't have said that to Nebuchadnezzar. Oh, he was mad at you before. Now it's going to be even harder. Was God saying that? No. He was saying, wow, these guys are so firm in their faith that they're going to defy this king. They're standing here and they're going to follow what I say no matter what happens in front of all these people. And in front of this heathen king, they're so faithful that no matter what happens to them, they're going to remain faithful. I have a huge opportunity here to make an impact on all these people. And sorry. I think God probably had to hold that old furnace together to keep it from blowing up, just so that he could answer that prayer of faith from Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And when the furnace was so hot that even the soldiers on the outside keeled over dead from the heat, when it was a totally impossible situation, he waited until the very end. Then is when he stepped in and burned the ropes that tied their hands and feet off without touching their skin, and he walked around in that furnace with them to show that heathen king and all those thousands of people that he is God and that he answers the prayer of faith. And Lonito, seeing that wall of flames, his back to his tender dress, it's roaring down on him. It's a mile long, so he can't run around it. When the wind starts to overpower him and the flames begin to singe his hair, then the same God of Elijah, the same God of the three Hebrews, the same God who enjoys doing the impossible, in answer to Lonito's prayer of faith, stooped down and answered. Now, I don't know whether he sent an angel or a legion of angels, but I kind of like to think that Christ himself came down in response to Lonito's prayer of faith and put his hand, his protecting hand, over him and blew into that wall of flame. All Lonito knows is instantly his body felt cold. The blisters went away. He started feeling he could breathe again. Instantly, a strong wind began blowing directly behind him into that wall of flame. And he said it was so strong that you could see the two wind fronts, you know, and hear the shriek of wind as the flames and the wind were trying to push against each other. And he said that the flames continued to burn down on either side of the hut, but where Lonito was, the flame stopped dead. The fire joined up again and burned on down the island, but it was burnt black except for a little oasis of brown dirt with a dry thatched hut in the middle. When Lonito came to the house, I was recovering some from malaria, but when he told me this, I said, I got to see this. So we drove down, and I walked out to the field 2 days later, and I saw the blackened earth there. I saw tree branches that had been over the hut with leaves burnt to a crisp, and yet the dry grass underneath it was not touched. I also saw where the fire burned right up in a straight line. You can't really see it that well, but you can see it's black on this side. And it was in an exactly straight line about 6 inches away from that hut where it had burned right up and where God said, nope, you can't go any further. I walked softly because I felt that that ground was holy. Yes, God loves to do the impossible to our prayer of faith. But there's a second reason why God likes to do the impossible, and that is he loves to do the impossible in order to build our faith. You remember the story when Joshua was fighting the Amorites in the Lord's presence, in the presence of all Israel? On the day the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, "Sun, stand still over Gibeon, O moon over the valley of Ajalon, So the sun stood still and the moon stopped till the nation avenged itself on its enemies. The sun stopped in the middle of the sky and delayed going down about a full day. There has never been a day like it before or since, a day when the Lord listened to who? A man. Surely the Lord was fighting for Israel. Can you imagine the guts that it would take for Joshua to make a prayer like that? In the presence, he's surrounded by soldiers, and they're looking to him, his commander, and he says, God, I want that sun to stop right there. I wouldn't have the guts to do that. But Joshua did. And God honored his prayer of faith, did he not? And when I think, if I was an Israelite fighting with Joshua and I saw that God was doing that for Joshua, don't you think our faith would grow? My faith would grow. I would say, yeah, God's got to be in this. I mean, to stop the sun and the moon like that. Joshua was fighting the Lord's battles. He just didn't have enough daylight left to finish it. And so he asked God to do the impossible. I think God was delighted to answer Joshua's prayer. And he suspended the laws of nature. And they knew that the Lord was with them in that battle. And that I think their faith grew. When's the last time you asked God to stop the sun for you? The Bible's full of stories like that. We don't have time to look at them all, but impossible storms on Galilee that Jesus calmed, impossibly thick walls of Jericho that tumbled and crumbled into dust, Jonah treading water in the middle of an ocean with no, you know, land was hundreds of miles away, probably. God provides a fish and has him throw him up on land. Gideon, 300 men against an impossibly huge Midianite army. In all these stories, God did the impossible and strengthened their faith. Pistachio was out in the jungle one day looking for posts for a new hut. The hut only lasts maybe 2 years because of the massive termites. Actually, I've seen termites blot out the moon and the sun because of, I mean, termites love that kind of rainy weather, I guess. So you got to keep rebuilding his hut. And so he's out looking for posts to build his hut. And he found himself going up this dry creek bed, looking along the banks for the right size post. Well, he came into a little valley, canyon is what I'm trying to say, and smooth rock walls, pretty smooth stones where the creek was, and he's looking for these posts. Well, something else was looking for something too. There was a Dupong viper who was coming down the same creek as Pistachio was going up, and he was looking among the rocks for something to eat. Now, you don't have to believe me, but a Dupong viper, if he bites you, you have 4 seconds to live. I've had people come up and said, Tim, there's not such a snake. Well, all I know is that I've talked with people who have seen people die, and it takes about 4 seconds. All I know is I don't want to be bit by one. Whether it's 4 seconds or 5 minutes, I don't care. It still kills you. So Pistachio sees, he comes to this dry waterfall or cliff, and he sees a stand of trees on the top that are just the right size. So he starts to climb up this cliff, and he comes about halfway up. There was a ledge about 4 feet square. Just as he arrives at that ledge, oh, by the way, that snake, he's very vicious and he can run faster. He can travel faster than you can run. I mean, he's mad. He stays mad. And he'll tackle cows, horses, you name it, anything big, humans. So he's a very aggressive snake. Well, this snake, he's looking over the side, and he sees Pistachio there on the on the ledge, and he hurdles himself directly off the ledge, right through the air, just right towards Stachio. Stachio looks up and sees his black snake hurtling toward him, and all he had time to do was throw up a hand, and he screamed, "Father!" And then nothing, he opened his eyes, nothing hit him. He quickly looked around, no snake. He climbed back down, he looked along the banks of the creek, no snake. The snake disappeared. Now, this seems to be kind of an on-again, off-again Seventh-day Adventist. But after this, after he was saved from certain death, he was well-grounded. He had faith that God was in this. And now, actually, he's my son's father-in-law. Yep. That's John's father-in-law. Yep. Well, we are all talking about this happened in 2003. The same God that stopped the sun for Joshua and who calmed the violent storm on Galilee, who provided a fish for Jonah, he's still alive today. And he's still doing the impossible in order to strengthen our faith. But there is a third and final reason why God enjoys doing the impossible. He enjoys doing the impossible so that we'll know that he is God. He wants us to know that he is God and all that involves. Have you noticed that God likes to wait until the last possible instant before he works? It's frustrating, but that's how he likes to work. You remember when the children of Israel were released from their slavery after, you know, God worked all kinds of miracles and the plagues, and they're guided by this pillar of fire, not to go on any of the established roads through the desert, but they go into a dead end, and there's a Red Sea in front of them. There's mountain sides on either side, and guess what's coming up behind? This angry Egyptian army, and they were bent on revenge. And how God waited until the absolute last possible instant before he does anything. I think he probably let the army come right up to the edges of the people before he comes, you know, with the cloud in between. He opens the road through the sea, the people go through, and then he closes the sea and drowns all their problems behind them. Don't you think that after that experience, I think I would anyway, that the children of Israel, you know, they had grown up with these Egyptian gods that they saw everybody worshiping. Don't you think after this experience that they started to realize that who God really was, that he was the true God, he was God. You remember when Jesus deliberately waited until Lazarus had been in the grave 4 days and his body was starting to stink? Until he waited until it was, nobody had any doubt whatsoever that Lazarus was truly, truly dead. And you remember how he commanded the stone to be rolled away, and then standing there in front of the grave, he called Jesus the life giver, called Lazarus forth, and raised him from the dead. How many people witnessing that started to realize that, you know, this Jesus truly is the Son of God? When is the last time that you prayed for someone to come back to life? 3-year-old Rizan was sick. He lay on his mat all day, all night, moaning and clutching his head. in pain. His labored breathing was louder than the grunting of pigs and the tinkle of his mother's pot as she cooked her food. He was burning up with fever, and had a hard time breathing because he had malaria and pneumonia. Often they come together. Well, his parents had paid the witch doctor a chicken, and he had blown the smoke of a burning piece of ginger all over Rizan's body, but he didn't get well. They paid him another chicken, and this time he brushed the wing back and forth over the body while he mumbled his incantations and talked to his spirit friends, but Rizan didn't get well. They gave the witch doctor their only pig for another ritual. Ritual after ritual, week after week, and Rizan got worse and worse and worse until finally he was very close to death. In desperation, the parents packed up the one or two chickens they had left and their little pot and their machete, and they went down to the village of Maiba, where they had heard that there was two healthcare workers that knew how to treat illnesses who had been trained by Don. Well, Pablito immediately put Rizan on malaria medication and antibiotics for the pneumonia, and he began to recover, but his mother, Bunswanan, either she really just didn't, they don't know time too much, and they're not really, can't remember, you know, you take a pill here, take a pill. We had to say, okay, take the pill when the sun's here, and when the sun's here, and when the sun's here, because otherwise they don't know. Well, anyway, she had forgotten many times to give them his medicine, and one morning as she had breakfast, she looked over there, and Rizan had died. Well, she immediately screamed, which brought the whole village running to see what was the matter, and they walk in the hut, and there is the father, Julio, holding his dead son. Now, an Alangan doesn't cry when someone dies because they feel that the water from your tears creates a mist and it keeps the dead person from crossing over, so they don't cry. But this kind of just took her by surprise, and she couldn't, you know, the husband said, you know, stop crying. She couldn't stop crying. She was wailing and carrying on because that was her only son was dead. Now, 7 years before that, Bunswanan had actually been baptized into the Seventh-day Adventist Church. In fact, she was one of our first women converts. But because they have prearranged marriages, even when they're little babies, they'll promise to somebody. And her father had forced her to carry through with that. So far back in the mountains where this guy lived, she had to live and never had any contact with church members. And after a while, she just kind of drifted back into her old animistic ways. But now this sudden crisis brought all that back to her. And so through her tears, she called for a little child and said, go get the Adventist elders and bring them here. So a little child took off. They were Awning and Pablito were about 30 minutes away plowing. So the kid went and got them and brought them back. And when they walked in the hut, here's Rizan, still dead, still in his father's arms. And they looked and they said, what do you want us to do? And Bunswanan said, I want you to pray to your God to bring my son back to life. Whoa. Pablito looked at Awning, and Awning looked at Pablito. And they said to each other, we don't know what to do. The missionary never told us about praying for dead people. Maybe it'd be a sin if we did that. It's true that, you know, in Bible times, you know, Jesus and some of the prophets and all that would healed, and the apostles, they healed. But that was a long time ago. This is now. And then they remembered something. They remembered John 14, what we heard in our scripture reading. Jesus said, I will do whatever you ask. How many things? whatever. Whatever you ask in my name, so that what? So that you can become rich or have a new car? No. So that the Son may bring glory to the Father. You may ask me for how many things? Anything in my name, and I will do it. I got to admit that sometimes these simple people of the jungle have a lot more faith than I do. And I've grown up in the full light of the gospel all my life. They don't have to know the theology and the background and all that stuff. If Jesus said it, that's it. That's all that matters. Whereas I'm a little more skeptical, a lot more skeptical. But when they remembered this promise, they started thinking, you know, if we ask Rezon, if we ask God to bring Rezon back to life as a witness to his parents, well, then that would be bringing God glory, right? So they said, okay, let's do it. Well, Rezon's face and air passages were full of white matter and stuff. So they figured, well, if God's going to bring him back to life, he's going to have to breathe, so we need to clean that out. So they cleaned it all out. And then they put Rezon back in his father's arms. And then they knelt down and began, and they said, you know, Julio Ben Swanen, we've seen the Spirit really do some amazing things, haven't we? Yeah, we have. Well, Father God, the Creator God, is way more powerful than those guys are. And he said that whatever we pray for and ask in his name, he will do. Now we know he will bring Rezon back to life. As a witness for you to know that he is God. Now, if Rezon doesn't come back to life, because it'll be because God's will is that he not come back to life. That's just God's will. That doesn't mean, though, that he is powerless. That means that his choice is Rezon needs to stay dead. God is still the most powerful God there is. Kind of reminds you of the prayer of the three Hebrews, right? So they placed their hands on Rezon's head and each offered up a simple prayer asking for Rezon's life back. And when they opened their eyes, Rezon opened his. Are you facing an impossible situation in your life, maybe right now? Perhaps you're struggling. Maybe your faith is kind of wavering. Or maybe you're feeling your life is out of control and you just don't know where to go. Are you tired of trying to find earthly solutions and you want to develop that heavenly eyesight? God is longing to answer your prayer of faith. He's willing to take that tiny grain of faith and use it to move away mountains of difficulty. He wants to show you that he is God. I challenge you today, God enjoys the impossible. Why not let him do the impossible in your life